From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As political paralysis in Washington brings the nation ever closer to default, the press has had little trouble covering the brinksmanship over the nation's debt ceiling.
Leaders from both political parties still struggling to reach a deal to raise the nation's debt ceiling.
As a bipartisan deficit reduction deal appears more and more unlikely.
Here's the prevailing media narrative. The Republicans want the government to live within its means, like ordinary Americans. The Democrats want the wealthy, who enjoy disproportionately low tax rates, to pay their fair share. And Washington is playing a serious game of chicken that the president, as the nation's in loco parentis in chief, seems unable to stop. That's the narrative in which every statement is viewed from the prism of politics. Here's President Obama, followed by GOP presidential hopeful Michelle Bachmann.
I cannot guarantee that those checks go out on August 3rd if we haven't resolved this issue, because there may simply not be the money in the coffers to do it.
We were all shocked and appalled that President Obama dangled out in front of the cameras that senior citizens may not get their checks. That's a very dangerous statement to make.
The fiscally conservative British news magazine The Economist wrote this week that Republicans are, quote, clinging to the position that not a single cent of deficit reduction must come from a higher tax take. This is economically illiterate and disgracefully cynical.
But The Economist was unusual in addressing the economic arguments at all. The media's obsession with the debt drama has left many Americans confused about the underlying economic realities. As U.S. News and World Report's chief business correspondent Rick Newman wrote recently, outside the Beltway, there is some consensus. Many economists, corporate CEOs, and those on Wall Street can agree that the debt ceiling situation needs to be resolved, and quick, with a combination of spending cuts and increased taxation. The economic consensus, though, is buried in the drama of the political showdown. The question is, if there is so little to debate, why obsess about the debate? Rick Newman says that all the coverage the public needs is there if the audience is willing to sift through all the irrelevancies to find it. But the media are once again trapped in the losing proposition of giving equal time and equal respect to all parties.
If it has a claim to objectivity, it has to treat each position with equal credibility. And the way that that's playing out in this debate is over this issue of taxes. Most economic experts or mainstream economists say there is no way to solve this problem without a combination of spending cuts and tax increases. But the Republicans are digging in their heels and saying no tax increases. And President Obama has basically said he will accept something that is about 75% spending cuts and 25% tax increases. That is a moderate position based on the whole range of recommendations we've seen, but the media is struggling with how to relate to that. So they have to say Obama on one hand and these Republicans on the other hand, and that's where I think people get pretty confused.
What if, and this is just a suppose, but what if this is a case, as we have seen in other issues, let's say climate change, for example, where one side is right, the other side is just flatly wrong. But because the situation is so politicized, the press can't just categorically say, you know, this side is right. Let's just say what the nation requires right now is a combination of deep spending cuts and modest tax gains. What if reality has a liberal bias? Is the press capable of dealing with that?
That is a tough one for the press, because the stereotype is the press is liberal and the press tries to prove that it's not. And it does recall the debate about WMD leading up to the Iraq war, and the New York Times and others were criticized for not being tough enough on claims that Iraq had WMD. And there is some likelihood that the reason they weren't tough is because they didn't want to seem too liberal or too partisan on the liberal side. And we may be in that situation now, specifically with regard to this question of should there be some tax increases to help close the deficit.
Is it possible that the press is actually incapable of performing its function of informing its audiences, because it would be dismissed as simply propagandizing for the president and the Democratic Party?
There is definitely this sort of journalistic whiplash that reporters get when they're trying so hard to be fair that they feel like maybe they're not giving people the best information or guiding them to the best information. But I think that if we really do get closer to the blink moment when it does look like we may actually have to start cutting spending by that 40% and the borrowing limit may not be raised, I think that's the point at which the press will get a little more diligent about figuring out, okay, who do we really fault for this? But at the moment, we are getting this on the one hand, on the other hand type of reporting. So the burden is on citizens to remain informed, and it takes a lot of work to stay informed about complicated issues like this.
Rick, thank you.
My pleasure.
Rick Newman is chief business correspondent for U.S. News and World Report.
Amid the talk of cutting government programs to fit under the debt ceiling, consider this surprising finding. In a nationwide survey, Cornell professor Susan Mettler found that many, perhaps a majority of people enrolled in government programs, do not understand that they are receiving government benefits. They include 60% of homeowners who qualify for a home mortgage interest deduction, 44% of Social Security recipients, 39% of those on Medicare, and 53% of people with government-backed student loans. Danny Hayes is a professor of government at American University who studies Americans' changing political perceptions, and he has some thoughts on what appears to be the nation's cognitive dissonance.
Student loans is a really good example of what Suzanne Mettler and other scholars have referred to as the submerged state, right? The social welfare state that is largely hidden from public view. When people pay off their student loans, they are not writing a check directly to the government, and they're not getting communication in many cases directly from the government. They're getting from a third-party lender. This is one of the reasons that these benefits of government are often hidden from view, because in some ways, we don't actually interact directly with the government when we're engaging with them.
So let's apportion some blame here for this resistance to the notion that much of the public is being supported by some kind of government program. First of all, politicians.
Well, the Democrats are in a difficult position when it comes to government programs. On the one hand, they benefit politically from calling the public's attention to the fact that they've supported programs like Medicare and Social Security and things that many Americans like. But on the other hand, in the abstract, Americans don't like the notion of quote-unquote big government. And so I think the Democratic Party doesn't want to put itself in the position of being cast as the tax and spend party, as Republicans often accuse them of being. But I also want to make clear that many of these programs that are at issue here, things like the mortgage interest deduction and tax credits, are also supported by Republicans. But Republicans have a different motivation for not wanting to draw attention to them. It's not that they're afraid of being cast as the party of big government, but that they don't really see it that way. They see it as giving Americans back their money, right? That is money that they should never have to give to the government in the first place. And so when Republicans talk about these things, they don't frame it in terms of these are government benefits. They frame it in terms of these are protections that we are providing you from the government. And so in many ways, because the media serve as a conduit for these elite arguments, those arguments by politicians are what really kind of drive the way that Americans think about these programs.
That's when they discuss the programs at all. But as you've observed, there are things that are baked into the business of journalism that seems to argue against discussing the details.
Media outlets tend to prefer stories about process, stories that focus on which politician's winning, which politician's losing, but the implications of the policies that are being debated, the cuts to spending, what will that mean for Americans, don't get much attention. But it's also the case that policy stories don't get attention because they're harder to write at all. Journalists have to know more. And I'm not suggesting that journalists are lazier, that they don't care about policy. But especially from the perspective of people who work for daily news outlets, it's very difficult to write substantive, thoughtful, careful, nuanced policy stories within an 8-hour window and then write another story the next day.
Also, each time you have to explain what each of these policies is and what they do, just like they have to explain what cap and trade is each time. And that's boring, right?
Well, that's one of the things that works against a focus on policy, right? One of the things that's important here, too, is that some of these programs are supported by politicians in both the Democratic and Republican parties. And so when politicians don't fight over the substance of policies, the media often don't pay attention. Conflict is what drives the narrative. In moments where things like the GI Bill or Social Security are debated publicly, and so they get a lot of attention in the media, Americans are more likely to attach the benefits they receive to that to government policies, right? Because they're being constantly reminded that these are things that the government is providing them. But for many of these policies, they're not voted on a regular basis, and so are not subject to political debate, and thus the media don't give them a lot of coverage. Thus, citizens aren't reminded about the programs, and so they're just kind of baked into the way that we go about our daily lives, and we don't think of them as government expenditures on our behalf.
It still astounds me that 27% of people who have subsidized housing or get welfare or get Medicaid claim that they have not used a government social program.
It really is stunning, but it also has to do with the associations that are raised in citizens' minds when we think of people who receive government benefits, which stems in part from the debates in the 80s and 90s about welfare queens and people on the dole and the arguments about welfare reform that were prominent during the Clinton administration. Because of that, they don't want to associate themselves with that image that they have of what a government beneficiary is, even though that's not really an accurate characterization. They just don't think of themselves that way. And so when they get asked survey questions like this, they say, no, not me.
Well, that's great. So we are able to blame the politicians and the media and also the news consumer. Does that suggest that any of this can change?
There's lots of research in political science that shows that when people are provided factual information about the consequences of public policies, they will often change their views. Media coverage often reflects the debate inside the Beltway, but that doesn't have to be the case, right? There's nothing in the rule book of journalism that says you have to pay attention to what Democrats and Republicans are saying and not paying attention to anything else. News organizations could free up some reporters to do more in-depth policy coverage. They could provide more information of the sort that we've talked about. And so there's nothing deterministic and there's nothing inevitable about the nature of coverage that we have today.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Danny Hayes is a former journalist and now a professor of government at American University.
Coming up, will your internet service provider become an internet copyright cop?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Lately, we've been following the saga of Righthaven, a group of lawyers that buys copyrights on articles from newspapers and then sues whoever reposts them or parts of them online without permission. Righthaven then splits the proceeds of the lawsuit or the settlement with the papers. And it's been a sweet deal. Righthaven sends no warnings or takedown notices. It just skips straight to the lawsuit, usually asking for $150,000 and for the accused to forfeit the website. Most of the alleged infringers, being small blogs and individuals, just settle. But here's the rub. It turns out that Righthaven, which has worked primarily with Stevens Media, the parent company of several newspapers, was only buying the part of the copyright that allowed it to sue for infringement, leaving the rest of the copyright with the newspapers. Last month, the Democratic Underground, a website that decided to fight back with the help of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, scored a massive win over Righthaven when Nevada Judge Roger Hunt said that Righthaven simply didn't own enough of the copyright to have legal standing to sue. Now, Righthaven is scrambling to amend its filings to claim ownership of the entire copyright. But according to paidcontent.org's Joe Mullen, the Democratic Underground case may have struck Righthaven a mortal blow.
They made Righthaven lose standing in not just their case, but probably dozens or even all of their cases, because essentially the copyrights weren't truly transferred from Stevens Media to Righthaven. Stevens Media had too much control over the copyright to say that it had truly transferred it. The judge said that Righthaven, in its statements to the court, had been, quote, disingenuous, if not outright deceitful, and that Righthaven had broken local Nevada rules of litigation when it did not explain from the get-go that it had a financial arrangement with Stevens Media. The judge said that was, quote, the most factually brazen of multiple inaccurate and likely dishonest statements to the court. So that's the case that turned this into a real fiasco. It's not hard to imagine a situation in which Right Haven ends up having to make substantial payouts to one or more defendants.
Do you have any idea why, from the get-go, Right Haven didn't just establish ordinary legal counsel arrangements with these copyright holders?
First of all, if a newspaper under its own name went out and sued more than 200 outlets, mostly small blogs and websites, there would have been bad public relations repercussions from that. The other reason is that Right Haven thought that it could create a moneymaker by getting copyrights from multiple newspapers and really creating a business out of this. And it appears Stevens Media thought that it could make some money on that too. Stevens Media invested a significant amount of principal in Right Haven. That number is reportedly $500,000. They, like the lawyers behind Right Haven, hope that this turns into a truly profitable national enterprise that has all kinds of newspaper clients. But it looks like they'll be lucky if they get that $500,000 back.
We've been talking about Judge Hunt's ruling. He is a federal judge in Nevada. His decision doesn't necessarily have any bearing on what other judges should decide in other cases in other courts. But the CEO of Right Haven has talked about appealing to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. What would that mean?
First of all, we don't know that they'll fare any better on appeal than they did in the lower courts. But also, it might take a year for that process to move ahead, and Right Haven is going to have to support its business during that time. And there's questions about how they can do that. They aren't filing more suits. That suggests that the legal resources they have are maxed out, and they have multiple counterattacks. There's a class action claim against them. There's a claim against them that they're practicing law without a license. People are asking the Nevada State Bar to investigate them. Those counterattacks really might not go anywhere, but they will take more of Right Haven's time and energy to defend.
Steve Gibson, the CEO of Right Haven, who has been on our show, maintains that it is set up to deter people from stealing other people's content. That's a noble motive, isn't it?
The real controversy here is in Right Haven's tactics. There was an industry standard sort of developing. If you're a reuser of content or an aggregator of content, the right way to do it is an excerpt and a link. And if you're a copyright owner and you're upset about how someone is using your content, the right way to begin that discussion is with a takedown notice. Sue first is really not the industry standard. And it's not clear the case law that they're creating is helping the newspaper industry at all, which was their stated intention. In fact, it might be doing the opposite.
All right, Joe. Once again, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun.
Joe Mullen covers legal affairs for paidcontent.org.
Last week, the nation's largest internet service providers, including Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T, struck a deal with the nation's largest content providers, the Motion Picture and Recording Industry Associations of America. The ISPs agreed to follow the content industry's so-called copyright alert system. The system works like this. Let's say you're on the internet and you just happen to be downloading a movie that, let's say, is pirated. If the content provider sniffs you out, it alerts your ISP, and the ISP warns you that what you're doing is illegal. That's strike one. In this game, you get six strikes. Each strike triggers a variety of other warnings, and eventually your internet speed could be deliberately slowed down, or worse. Internet watchers like Timothy B. Lee, an adjunct professor at the Cato Institute, are of two minds about the announcement. On the one hand, it's not the three strikes rule that they'd feared. On the other hand, internet service providers are now copyright enforcers.
The network providers are kind of caught between a rock and a hard place because on the one hand, they're getting a lot of pressure from copyright holders and perhaps from people in Washington to do more to crack down on peer-to-peer file sharing. But on the other hand, their paying customers are their users. Generally, it's not good in business to anger your own customers. So they've been trying to sort of thread this needle.
There has been something of a turnaround. You quote in your article an AT&T letter to the Office of Management and Budget last year, writing that private entities are not created or meant to conduct the law enforcement and judicial balancing act that would be required for a copyright alert system like this.
This is a position that the ISPs have stuck to for a long time, that they're just a neutral conduit for other people's information, and it's really a dispute between the copyright holder and the users. I think there's two things that might be going on. One of them is that the White House is widely credited with, quote-unquote, brokering this agreement. Maybe they said, well, you know, if you don't do this voluntarily, we might have to look at maybe some kind of regulatory solution. The other thing that's changed in recent years is that a lot of these ISPs, particularly AT&T and Verizon, have gone into the content business. Before maybe the middle of the last decade, the services Verizon offered you were just phone and internet. And what changed is when they rolled out Fios, there's now a Fios television option that's basically the same thing as cable television. And in order to run that service, they need to get content from Hollywood. And that, I think, gives the copyright holders a little bit more leverage over these network providers.
Another argument that AT&T made was the slippery slope argument, that now they're asking to police their users for copyright infringement. Maybe later it'll be for gambling or for porn.
We would be pretty outraged if your phone company was punishing you based on what kind of telephone calls you made. And I think the principle that internet service providers are neutral conduits, their job is just to move packets to and from your computer, is a relatively important one. Once you erode that principle, there's going to be all sorts of people who say, well, now that you're in the business of stopping people from doing bad things on the internet, I've got another bad thing I'd like you to help stop. These network providers have neither sort of the expertise or the right incentives to make good decisions. And so I think the right thing for them to do is probably what they were doing before this agreement, which is that if they got a complaint from a copyright holder, they would pass it along to the user and they would provide the user subscription information only pursuant to a court order.
But is this so unreasonable? So you get a handful of re-education notices from Verizon if what you're doing is illegal. Why shouldn't Verizon let you know?
Well, so there's two pieces to this. They've always been doing the alerts. That's not what's new. What's new here are these so-called mitigation measures. And the problem with that is that an accusation from a copyright holder is just that, an accusation. Maybe they got it right, but maybe they didn't. And it's important, I think, if somebody accuses you of committing a crime, for you to have an opportunity to give your side. Now, there is a process in this copyright alert system where you can appeal, but you have to pay $35 for the privilege of defending yourself, and it's not really clear exactly what the standards are going to be. It's not clear exactly who's going to be the neutral party who will hear these kinds of disputes.
Has any ISP said exactly what will happen as the strikes pile up? Does it start with a slowdown? Ultimately, is it the sudden death of getting knocked off the internet?
I think that they've said that getting knocked off the internet is not one of the options, although obviously that could change. But yeah, it's up to the ISP's discretion. I think there's a pretty clear sense that customers don't want three strikes or six strikes approach where they actually get kicked off the internet. And so to mollify content industry, they are coming up with things that they think are less punitive than the six strikes. And the vaguer they are about that, the easier it is to make both sides happy. I think where the rubber will really meet the road on this is when they actually start to get some customers who are getting to their fourth and fifth strikes, and then it can't be abstract anymore. They actually have to decide which customers get which kind of penalties.
Okay, so why should we care?
I think it's important because if you got accused of some crime, if your electricity got shut off or your water got shut off, that would be a pretty severe punishment, and we would really want to have some due process. I think the same sort of concerns can be raised about the ISPs. The other reason we should be concerned is I don't think this is a stable situation. Now that the ISPs have conceded the principle that they have some role in enforcement, this is the sort of thing where once the ISPs give an inch, the people who want them to be enforcement will take a mile.
Timothy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Timothy B. Lee is an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute and a writer for the tech site Ars Technica.
We just heard an example of self-regulation, ISPs agreeing to police the behavior of their users, but there are also government regulations in the works. One bill making its way through Congress is called Protect IP, or, ready for this, the Preventing Real Online Threats to Economic Creativity and Theft of Intellectual Property Act of 2011. Whew. The act would allow the Justice Department to label a website an infringing site, meaning that that site is misappropriating copyrighted material. under Protect IP. If a site is deemed infringing, advertising companies couldn't work with it, payment processors like Visa or MasterCard couldn't handle its transactions, search engines couldn't include the site in search results, and your ISP could block it. TechDirt's Michael Masnick has several problems with the Protect IP legislation, but Masnick's biggest issue is that the definition of an infringing site is too broad and too vague, and that's a big problem, he says, for innovation.
When the player piano first came about, that was declared as dedicated to infringing activity. When the radio first came about, when cable television came about, when the VCR came about, it was said that the VCR would act to the movie industry as the Boston Strangler. When YouTube came about, all of these things were declared as dedicated to infringing activity. And under a law like Protect IP, by making a case that that's true, you could potentially have blocked out all of these technologies and not allowed them to become a very legitimate part of all of these industries.
Stifling innovation. Mm-hmm. But more than that, a broad definition you've written would raise the question of legality of things that we really don't think are or should be illegal.
That's the big concern. As an example of this, the advertising firm WPP recently put together a big list of sites that they decided were dedicated to infringing activity. This list was put together with the help of Universal Music, Paramount Pictures, and Warner Brothers Studio. And some of the names on that list are sites that you would not normally think are dedicated to infringing activity. And that includes the Internet Archive, which is, you know, one of the most popular, most useful research tools out there. Also on that list, Vibe.com. Vibe magazine was founded by Quincy Jones. It's considered the leading classic magazine and publication around hip-hop and R&B, and yet it's on this list. Based on the fact that certain parties declare it dedicated to infringing activity, you know, it could run afoul of Protect IP and suddenly, you know, basically be put out of business by something like this.
It gets so convoluted that Universal Music has gone after some of its own artists because those artists, like 50 Cent, put their music on their websites.
Yeah, 50 Cent has his own personal website. There's also an official Universal Music website. His own personal website gets a lot more traffic, and it appeared on this list of sites dedicated to infringing activity, his own personal website. And he is a Universal Music recording artist, and Universal Music helped put together this list.
You not only report on the issue of copyright infringement, but you are yourself right smack in the middle of a controversy based on some photographs which, of course, were taken by monkeys.
I was wondering if this was going to come up. Yes, there was a news story that was making the rounds last week about a photographer who was in Indonesia and had left his camera out in a jungle somewhere or nature preserve. And some monkeys apparently happened on the camera and played around with it for a while and ended up taking pictures of themselves. The pictures are quite amazing, actually, when you look at them. And certainly lots of news sources covered just the fact that these monkeys took these self-portraits. But what struck us was that the images had copyright notices on them directly. And we began to wonder whether or not those copyright notices were legitimate. And that's because, generally speaking, it's the photographer. Whoever actually takes the shot is the one who gets the copyright, even if you're using someone else's camera. So in this case, the photographer happens to be the monkey, which raises all sorts of interesting legal questions. And in general, animals are not allowed to possess copyright. You know, if you look at the law, it seems pretty clear that these photographs are technically in the public domain.
And yet,
the person who owned the camera, he appears to be claiming that he has the copyright and then licensed it to a group called Cater's News Agency. And they sent us a request to take down the images saying that we can't post it.
They aren't even necessarily asserting that they or the photographer own the copyright. They just made the point that you don't own it and therefore you have no right to post it, which means anybody could decide to be the copyright police.
In fact, we don't believe that the photographer who owned the camera or Cater's News Agency technically owns the copyright either. We could turn around and demand that they take down their uses of the photos as well, based on their own logic.
The reason I'm making you go through this ridiculous story is that it kind of reminds me of the Protect IP Act itself, which presumes to be able to know who's got rights and who hasn't. I guess your point of view is their ability to do that is no better than the monkey people.
And the problem with the Protect IP Act, like the monkey people and the question of the monkey photographs, is that it's not so simple. And there are a lot of questions that are raised that can't be answered in something as simply as saying, well, that is clearly, without a doubt, infringing, without an actual legal process to determine whether or not that really was infringing. And that's a big problem with the Protect IP Act.
All right, Mike. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Masnick is editor of Tech Dirt and founder of Floor 64, which does business and tech analysis for companies. Hey, if you want to see the monkey, and you really want to see this monkey, go to our website, onthemedia.org.
Coming up, the News of the World scandal is the gift that keeps on giving.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Here's former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown in Parliament this week.
Many, many wholly innocent men, women, and children, at the darkest hour, at the most vulnerable moment in their lives, found their private tears bought and sold by News International for commercial gain.
This week, Rebecca Brooks resigned as head of the British newspaper division of Rupert Murdoch's News International. Les Hinton, who had run Murdoch's British newspapers until 2007, and then Fox News, and now the Wall Street Journal, followed her out the door. Also this week, Rupert Murdoch withdrew his multi-billion dollar ownership bid for the UK's largest pay TV service and agreed to attend a parliamentary hearing. Simon Hoggart is a Guardian columnist, and we reached him in the paper's bustling Parliament newsroom, where he told us that Murdoch's British empire seems to be on the wane at the moment. As for the future,
we don't know. It could be that he will sell his other British papers, the Times and the Sunday Times. The Sunday Times was accused of hacking into information about the former Prime Minister's bank statements. Of course, that didn't help things at all. So what we had on Wednesday was the whole of the British Parliament united in condemnation, I think loathing is not too strong a word, of the entire Murdoch empire.
This whole scandal has unveiled in great detail the interlocking relationships between the Murdoch empire, law enforcement in Britain, and even the highest reaches of government.
Well, we always knew that policemen took money for information, but it's a very serious offence. But of course, mainly it's done with used bank bills, no great sums of money involved. But this seems to have been on what we call an industrial scale now.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes a difference. And I think some policemen are going to find themselves quite possibly in jail, and indeed the people who paid them, and the former editor who used to work for David Cameron, our present Prime Minister.
Andy Coulson.
Yes, who approved the payments to corrupt police officers.
But what about Cameron himself?
Cameron himself is under great pressure. The Labour Party, which is still licking its wounds after an election defeat a year ago, sees a real opportunity to go for him.
What about Murdoch's image? He has a reputation as kind of a Wizard of Oz, doesn't he? The man behind the curtain?
Yes, Wizard of Australia. And I think what you're seeing now is the end of that particular movie, because the curtain has been drawn back and there's a rather old, confused elderly man who doesn't quite know what's hitting him. The fact that he didn't sack the chief executive, even though she was associated with the most terrible of the phone hacking. The fact that he was seen in all the pictures since he arrived in London, smiling with her as if there was nothing to worry about, as if he was just setting off on a rather nice vacation. He really seems to me to have lost the plot, frankly. I don't think Murdoch really understands what's going on.
I have one final question for you, and it has to do with The Guardian. Mm-hmm. Malfeasance on the part of the News of the World was for a long time The Guardian story and The Guardian story alone. It was a lonely crusade to get the world to pay attention. Is there some elation in the newsroom as you watch the entire British media landscape change because of what your paper reported?
Well, of course there is, yes. Though, frankly, it's been so incredibly busy and hectic over the past few days, I don't think people have really had time to be very elated. But yes, of course, and I have to pay tribute in particular to Nick Davis, the reporter, who went for this like a dog refusing to let go of a bone. And our editor, Alan Rusbridger, who, in the face of flat denials and basically hatred from many of his colleagues, again persisted with the story. They must be feeling a little bit smug and trying not to show it.
Simon, thank you so much.
You're more than welcome.
Simon Hoggart is a columnist for The Guardian.
As the News of the World scandal sends ripples across British society, from journalism to law enforcement to politics, will it wash onto American shores? This week, we heard reports that the FBI is looking into allegations that the phones of 9/11 victims were hacked by Murdoch's papers. And U.S. politicians are getting involved. West Virginia Senator Jay Rockefeller and New York Congressman Peter King are calling for investigations of Murdoch's News Corps. But that's not the only way the scandal could become an American story. ProPublica business and financial reporter Jake Bernstein says News Corps may have already violated a U.S. law.
It's possible that News Corps ran afoul of a 1970s-era law called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. This was something that came out of the Watergate era, and it's to stop companies from participating in bribery overseas. These are U.S. Traded companies.
To keep American, let's say, defense contractors from bribing ministers of defense to buy its tanks or fighter planes. In the case of News of the World, the allegation is that reporters and private detectives were bribing police for information. Does that law really apply here?
The Department of Justice and the SEC have defined a public official fairly broadly, so it could very well apply here.
Who has been prosecuted under this law?
This has become a very popular prosecution for the Department of Justice and the SEC recently. Just in 2005, they had only done 12 such cases. Last year, they did 54. The SEC had about $530 million in corporate settlements last year.
So let's just say the United States targets News Corps for corrupt foreign practices. There's two ways that could happen, right? The Justice Department you mentioned, and you also mentioned the SEC. What's the difference?
The Justice Department would be criminal, and so that's a sort of higher bar of proof. You need to show intent. I would guess that they'd probably have to show that this was going on at higher levels, that people knew about it. The SEC, it's civil, so it's not quite as rigorous in what you need to prove. It's interesting because the SEC can go after a company even if they don't charge them on the bribery stuff. They can charge them on what's called the books and records provision. If you pay off the policeman and you don't write it down in your company ledger as bribe to policeman, then this can be a problem because you haven't accurately kept your books and records.
Okay, let's just say News Corps is prosecuted criminally and undergoes a civil litigation from the SEC and is found to have bribed foreign officials. What happens next?
The penalties can be quite severe. On the SEC side, they can do a disgorgement, which means basically they have to give back all of their the gains that they got from this kind of practice, which in this case would be very difficult to calculate, because how do you decide what the benefit was from a scoop? On the criminal side, it's twice the amount of your ill-gotten gains, and also fines up to $25 million per violation.
Rupert Murdoch can shake a $10 million fine out of the sofa cushions. Financially, what is the risk here? Is the corpus of News Corps in any kind of jeopardy?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's a reputational risk. I mean, this certainly won't help the company to try to shake this scandal off. But then there's another aspect of this. Frequently, the SEC and the Department of Justice ask, as part of these settlements, that a monitor be put over the company to make sure that they don't do this kind of thing in the future. They also ask for a company-wide review so that the Justice Department or the SEC is satisfied that this kind of behavior is not happening in the other subsidiaries of the company. Those things can take years.
All right, Jake. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Jake Bernstein is a business and financial reporter at ProPublica.
Kinky sex, religion, a beauty queen, Mormon missionaries, kidnap at gunpoint. There was something in that story for everyone. It was a perfect tabloid story.
In 1977, a young American Mormon missionary named Kirk Anderson, studying in England, vanished and resurfaced a few days later with a remarkable story. He said that Joyce McKinney, a former Miss Wyoming whom he had dated, had followed him to London, kidnapped him at gunpoint, chloroformed him, imprisoned him in a cabin, and raped him. McKinney claimed that she and Anderson were in love, a love he had disavowed because of Mormon brainwashing. It was the perfect tabloid story, and the British tabs dove in, siding either with Kirk or with Joyce. Director Errol Morris, who had freed an innocent man on death row with his documentary The Thin Blue Line and probed the psyche of Robert McNamara in The Fog of War, has attempted to get to the bottom of the McKinney scandal in his latest documentary, Tabloid. He interviewed McKinney at length and found her views unchanged after 33 years.
Do you think a woman can rape a man?
No. I think that's like putting a marshmallow in a parking meter. A guy either wants to have sex or he doesn't. He has an erection or he doesn't.
Morris doesn't ever solve the mystery of what happened in that cabin in Devonshire. Instead, he serves up a series of conflicting narratives tracing the events of those days long ago.
Someone said I should call it Rasha Mormon. I've resisted that.
So you haven't actually opted to get to the bottom of it.
I may not have gotten to the bottom of it, but I don't think it's quite fair to say that I haven't tried. In history, we depend on evidence, whether it's first-person accounts of what happened, documents, et cetera, et cetera. But what if pieces of evidence are just missing? What do you do? Now, this story concerns an alleged kidnapping and rape in a rented love cottage off the coast of England. Did Joyce McKinney rape her ex-boyfriend, Kirk Anderson? There were three people who were in that love cottage. Joyce McKinney's close friend, KJ, who died a number of years ago. Joyce and Kirk Anderson. Only one person has talked to me. This was a big court case in England. You would think that there would be court records, police files that I could lay my hands on. A lot of stuff, for whatever reason, gone.
Why did you choose this story?
I don't know if I choose any of the stories that I've pursued. They choose me.
Oh, come on.
Okay, let's try it a second time. I'm a promiscuous reader. I saw an AP wire service story in the Boston Globe. Starts off with dog cloning. Bernan McKinney has cloned her beloved pit bull, Booger, and produced 5 mini boogers, as she describes them. I get to the bottom of the article. And there's a brief mention of the possibility that Bernan McKinney is Joyce McKinney. Joyce McKinney, the subject of a tabloid war in the late 70s in England. So it's that combination of A and B. Sex and chains, dog cloning.
What did you learn about tabloid journalism?
I feel deeply conflicted when I hear the word tabloid journalism because I love tabloid journalism. A lot of my stories really have come out of tabloid-like stories. Does tabloid journalism have to be bad journalism? Does it have to be destructive journalism? Does it have to be criminal journalism? I would argue no. The scandal that we're looking at today with News of the World, what they did goes so far beyond what would imagine any journalist doing. They have involved themselves in actual criminal behavior.
Fundamentally, what you're saying is that this whole News of the World scandal is giving tabloid journalism a bad name.
Well, it always had a bad name. It's giving it a worse name. Whatever journalism is, and I'm not altogether sure about what it is, but I do know one thing. On some level, it has to have a concern with the truth. In the movie that I just made, I'm left with the feeling that this tabloid war got completely out of hand.
Between the Express and the Mirror.
And the Sun. Let's not leave Murdoch completely out of this. One of the journalists, it's perhaps my favorite line in the movie, Peter Torre, says at one point,
he was taken in and chained to, Joyce claims it was ropes, not chains, but chain sounds better. Anyway, he was alleged.
What is this telling us? It's telling us that there is this narrative pull, the need to sell newspapers, the need to come up with a good story, versus what actually happened.
And if that's the case, you have said that the Joyce McKinney story has been told many thousands of times, the general shape of the story. You liken it to the Aeneid. And so give us those ultimate narrative elements that you see again and again that you explored in that.
Well, certainly the narrative of hopeless love that runs through this entire story. Joyce, in this amazing footage that I discovered, she had shot part of a film some 30 years ago, and she's narrating a fairy tale that she has written about herself.
Once upon a time, there was a little princess, the most beautiful little princess in all the land. But the little princess was unhappy, for she was lonely. Someday, she would find her kind, handsome prince, and he would sweep her up on
everything
a big,
that
wide
she
horse,
imagined
and he would
coming
take
true
her away
has
and
come
marry
true,
her,
as if she's followed some strange narrative script of her own devising. So many competing stories here. The tabloid war decided that they were going to play out the Joyce McKinney story in different ways. One paper decided that she was a virgin. The other paper, he decided she was a whore. No interest anymore in Joyce McKinney. She becomes fodder for competing narratives.
Biographers are sometimes subject to a kind of Stockholm syndrome, where they, I won't say fall in love with their characters, but they get inside their character's skin. Do you find that that's a problem?
No. And yes. I would have to say that I embrace Stockholm syndrome. I'm getting myself into trouble, but why not? And here's why. We know there are endless styles of journalism, endless ways in which one person can interview another person. We're all familiar with the Mike Wallace school of interviewing. You try to trap the person interviewed into a set of contradictions. I look at what I do as being the exact opposite. I try to learn something about the person I'm interviewing. I try to capture them and how they see themselves in the world. I also can't really interview people that I don't like on some level. If I can't see myself in them, I can't do it. Now, maybe this makes me a bad journalist, but I truly believe it's at the heart of my art.
So how does it feel when Joyce McKinney runs around saying, this is a travesty?
Well, the phrase I'm particularly fond of, she called my movie tabloid a celluloid catastrophe. She is certainly entitled to her opinion. I believe that this is a truly loving portrait. Most people come away from this movie really liking her and identifying with her, even in some cases.
Well, you have a grudging admiration for her persistence, but she's definitely a fruitcake.
Haven't you ever been involved in some kind of obsessive love?
Well, if so, nothing that calls to mind what Joyce McKinney was involved in.
She may have taken it to a new kind of extreme, but I think we all, I can, recognize themselves in this story. What is the essence of a tabloid story? I think it's the thought, this could have happened to me, and I'm so glad it didn't.
Errol Morris, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Errol Morris's new documentary, Tabloid, opens in theaters this week.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Emily Chin and Joe Rosenberg, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.